This is The God Show, a conversation about the human spirit with your host, Pat McMahon.
Have you told your friends about us? You know what? If you don't have any friends, you will if you tell strangers about us, because they'll be indebted. Us, well, this is The God Show, and we have a brand new show every Sunday at 8 o'clock in the morning. And then from then on, the good folks at the Star Worldwide Networks continue to play this perpetually until you finally have told all your friends about us. Now, I know that you might be in Switzerland and you might also be in New Jersey. And boy, the difference between New Jersey and Switzerland, the real bond here is this program, because this is the show that talks about man's humanity and sometimes the lack of it. Our guest today is Shlomo Levertov, Rabbi Levertov, one of the directors of the Chabad Jewish Center of Paradise Valley in Phoenix, Arizona, and the Phoenix Young Jewish Professionals Organization. A family man. I've known his dad. His dad was on this radio show a number of years ago. And now the test comes. Can Shlomi come up to those standards? Shlomi, welcome.
Thank you very much.
We're absolutely delighted. Well, particularly because of the fact that the whole concept of this, I was thinking, well, what if I had to title this hour of conversation? What would it be? And one of the titles I came up with was simply, "So You Want to Be a Jew?" And that isn't really that easy to do, is it?
It's not so easy. Not so easy, but it has a lot of meaning, and there's a lot of joy involved in that. So.
But if you're not born into the faith, and if you want to convert, that's when it becomes a little more difficult than saying, "So you want to be a Presbyterian?"
Right. We want to make sure that there's a commitment, and you really want it. You really want it, and we also want to make sure that you actually know what it is.
So how do you find that out?
So usually there are certain rabbinic, we call them rabbinic courts, or different rabbis who do conversion. Not all rabbis will do conversion.
Oh, it's a specialty.
It's a specialty.
Yeah.
It should be a specialty. And you'll approach one of those rabbis, or your personal rabbi will introduce you to one of those rabbis, and then they'll sit down and have a conversation, and then they'll kind of feel you out, try to find out why you want to become Jewish, and from there they'll try to see what books are recommended. And you know, there's a joke actually that there's a guy comes to a rabbi. He says, "I really want to be a Jew. I'll pay $1 million." The rabbi says, $1 million to be a Jew?" He said, "You can't. This is a process." He says, $2 million." The rabbi says, $2 million. He said, "You know, it sounds promising." He says, "Why do you want to be a Jew?" He says, "My mother was a Jew. My grandmother was a Jew. I want to be a Jew." The rabbi says, "Oh, for $2 million, we can do it."
And we are going to have Jewish humor throughout this entire hour. Because having been around Shlomi a little bit, that's a part of your life. Is it a part of Judaism? Humor, comedy.
Well, it's definitely a part of Judaism to be joyous. And actually, there's a story in the Talmud. The Talmud is one of the most special writings in the oral Torah of Judaism. And it says there was a certain rabbi, and before every class of his, he would start off with a joke. And then it also says that the rabbis laughed at the joke, so it must have been good jokes. And then he would start, and that was a way of opening up for understanding, for learning, and humor has kind of a way of breaking down some boundaries and some walls.
So let's start with a couple of lessons now in letting people know who are in the audience around the world about some of the things about Judaism that they thought they knew and didn't, or never even considered that they didn't know. Some of the simple, basic things, like, for example, the categories of Judaism: conservative, reform, and orthodox. Are these three different areas of belief, or what?
So the real categories in Judaism is Kohen, a priest, a Levite, and Israelite. Those are the real categories in Judaism from age old. In modern times, maybe people have labeled themselves based on observance, how much they observe of the Torah, and they label themselves based on that. But there are some theological differences or whatever it is, but those aren't real. Those aren't real labels that are. You're not going to find those labels in any Jewish books or any Jewish texts or anything like that. And really, what unites us all as Jews is that we believe in the Torah, and the Torah is from God, and the commandments are from God. And with time, we have to make sure that we adapt. We adapt our life to fit with the Torah, and not trying to adapt the Torah to fit with our life. And so every group in Judaism tries to, you know, has a little bit of a different spin on that. But I primarily know about Orthodoxy, and that's why I could really talk about Orthodoxy for the most part.
All right. So if someone moves from Passaic, New Jersey, to Phoenix, Arizona, and
they'll have a hard time getting a deli sandwich.
They're looking for a faith home that they'll be comfortable with. Would they be looking for a conservative synagogue, a reform synagogue, an Orthodox synagogue? Because so many churches in the world of Christianity in particular have those prefixes associated.
Yeah, so I'll say like this, that mainly as a Chabad rabbi, I really believe that labels are for shirts and not for Jews. So I would suggest to any Jewish person moving out here, I would suggest that they try a synagogue and see if they like it. And it's not about the labels. And I would obviously suggest they pick a traditional synagogue, a synagogue that follows tradition. And even if they themselves are not as observant, or they're not holding at that level, and they can't necessarily, but they should still, obviously tradition is what keeps us together, what keeps Judaism all around throughout the ages. And I would suggest that they would look into a more traditional synagogue. I wouldn't. What they would do is probably whatever they did back east. They would come out here and do this and do something similar. But it's important that you want to teach your children the most traditional path, and then they can make a decision on, you know, what's too hard for them, and they can't handle. They could do a little bit less. But you want to teach them what's at the highest standard. So
you said that you identified yourself as a Chabad rabbi. What does that mean?
So as a Chabad rabbi, it means that it's a group of Orthodoxy. People want to call us ultra-Orthodox. There's nothing Orthodox about us. We don't do anything normal. But no, as a Chabad rabbi, we follow a group of Hasidim based out of Brooklyn. And the Rebbe was the leader of the movement. And he had a broad vision to create Chabad centers all around the world. There's 4,500 Chabad rabbis around the world. It's the largest Jewish network around the world.
I live near one here, Chabad Lubavitch, on Glendale, Lincoln Drive.
So that's my dad's center, and he started in 1977 in Arizona, and there's many more. Since then, there's around 25 in the whole state. And the purpose is to go out into the world and to show Jewish people the beauty of Judaism, and to show them how warm it is and how exciting it is. And everyone on their own level, some of them don't come to services, but you'll meet them in their offices for a coffee and study with them. And others will just be a quick chat in the store until one day they might need some Jewish services, and they'll call you or whatever it is. But it's about making sure Judaism is accessible, financially accessible to people who can't afford, and also making sure that it's accessible to every single person, and making sure they have a warm, inviting environment.
If it's a conservative family, would they be completely comfortable with all of the teachings of the Hasidic Chabad temple?
They definitely would. They would find so much meaning and so much joy and so much excitement in Judaism. It would be a reverse therapy on the Sunday school lessons they learned back in the days in the Bronx.
But would they not find some dramatic differences?
They would find that there will be some differences that they weren't expecting, but nothing is thrown upon anyone to observe, and as it's just taught, and so therefore it wouldn't affect them in a negative way. They would just enjoy it and eventually maybe want to do it, maybe not, but they would enjoy the authentic teachings of Judaism.
We've talked about your life as a Chabad rabbi and Hasidic Judaism, which is a part of the Orthodoxy, am I right?
Yes. The main idea between Hasidic Judaism is that around about 300 years ago, in in Russia or Ukraine, there was a need for kind of finding joy in Judaism. Sometimes you get very stuck in the technical parts of Judaism, what's allowed, what's not allowed in any religion, in any part of life. Sometimes in a business, you get so involved in the technical parts of things and you forget that you have such a good product, and you just get so involved in all the accounting or whatever it is, and you can't really sell your product. So the Baal Shem Tov came and he started the Hasidic movement, and his point was that, of course, in all parts of Judaism, it's important to bring joy into every part. And it's not just about the technicalities, but you have to infuse it with joy. And from there, there were one Jew, two opinions. So eventually, his followers eventually started a couple different groups of Hasidic Judaism, and they're all beautiful. They all focus on different parts of joy in different areas, and Chabad is a part of that group.
C H A,
B A D.
All right, because
and the C H is Cha.
Yes, very well done. If people are making notes, I just want people to know that all of this so far has seemed to evolve into a, you know, there's a whole lot of stuff that are involved with the mechanics, whether you're a Catholic or you are a Southern Baptist or Hasidic Jew. There's an awful lot of mechanics. There's an awful lot of stuff on the periphery of all of these beliefs. And yet, Rabbi Shlomi Levertov says, it all comes down to joy.
Otherwise, joy is the oil that makes the gears turn. Otherwise, they stop turning, unfortunately.
Now, tell me about another part of the world of Judaism that I really find difficult to understand. And I read about these folks every once in a while. Ethiopian Jews. Are they just Jews who practice Judaism the way you do, or the way conservatives or reform Jewish families do, who happen to come from Africa? Or is it a different division of Judaism?
So I can't give any. I haven't done enough research to give anything conclusive, and it would be really hard to do a lot of research into it. However,
which proves conclusively, by the way, we don't rehearse the show.
There you go. I wasn't expecting this. Ethiopian Jews, it's very, the Jewish people were exiled throughout history. We've been exiled. They say that for most of the Jews started at 12 tribes, the 12 sons of Jacob. And it says that for the most part, if you go back to everyone, all the Jews nowadays, you're only getting 2.5 or 3 tribes. So there's another 10 tribes or however many tribes it is that were either assimilated or never came back or never made it back to the, that we don't know about. So it is possible that the Ethiopian Jews was a group of Jewish people who they kept their heritage and continued. There would be some things that they obviously, that, you know, that the practice isn't the exact same as ours. And so you would have to look into that and see exactly how much of their tradition is alike. And it's definitely possible for them to eventually become part of the Jewish, you know, it's hard to say what exactly. There were differences of opinion. Some rabbis said they have to convert, not a full-on conversion, but a conversion just out of doubt, because we're not sure. You know, there's a lot of different technicalities, like we were talking about before, about Jewish marriage, Jewish divorce, and all these different things that really are very technical. And if you don't do them right, it can really change a lot of things, marrying within the faith and stuff like that. So so some rabbis were of the opinion that it would probably be beneficial if they converted out of doubt.
But look what you knew about the Ethiopian Jews, and you were ready to give up this entire program, for crying out loud. I just read sometimes about the Ethiopian Jews emigrating to Israel, and they always had the prefix Ethiopian for some reason, and I didn't know whether they practiced the faith differently or not.
Yeah, well, Judaism, there are different things. The Torah gives certain parts of Judaism to the rabbis to make decrees to make sure that we don't come to go against the Torah. So it's different times in history they enacted certain decrees to be able to. So some of those decrees or some of those or even some basic learning of how to understand the laws of the Torah. It's a simple book, but it's not as simple as just reading. The Torah doesn't have vowels, so to just read the Torah properly, You have to have some sort of tradition because there's no vowels in the Torah. So anyone who tells you that, you know, they follow the Torah, but they don't follow what the rabbis say. Well, I'm going to ask them, how do they know how to read the Torah? There's no vowels in Torah, right? So along that, if you have a tradition that wasn't part of the main land of the Jewish people, so how did you follow the laws of the Torah? How did you know how to interpret them without having that tradition? Or is that tradition still there? So there's a lot of questions that come into play to see what exactly their practices are and their and stuff like that.
Is the position of the Torah in Judaism the same, with the same degree of reverence that the Bible has in Christianity?
So I don't know about the. I don't know too much. I mean, I know. I would say yes. I don't know exactly how Christianity views the Bible.
We'll bring the Methodist
and,
next
and all the intricates. But yes, the Torah is the Word of God. And there's after the Torah was finished, the five books of Moses, there were no more commandments were added, and God said, "This is it." If a prophet comes one day and says, "Hey, there's a new commandment," we know that it's not true because God said, "I'm not adding any more commandments." And so when the five books of Moses were closed, it was final, and that's the Word of God. And until it's not changing. So the only things that were changed later were traditions were added, but they were added as tradition. They weren't added as the Torah. So it's very important as someone who observes the Torah to know what's tradition and what's not tradition. And
all sounds very close to a lot of Christianity. Please, if you will, as long as we're spending this hour together, explain something that for ages I haven't been able to understand. As I drive on a weekend past your father's synagogue, the Chabad Lubavitch, and I see people coming for services, and the men, even in a Phoenix summertime, 112, 113 degrees, and they're wearing very, very heavy black clothing and a hat and a two- or three-piece suit, I drive a little further past Temple Beth Israel, and there's guys in golf sweaters and shirts and just simple, regular Presbyterian clothes. So tell me the difference.
Oh, we don't use technology so much, so it's hard for us to know the weather. So we just walk outside as if we're bundled in New York. And it's just
But why the outfits? Why the garb that we associate with the Orthodox?
So there's a the general idea of a suit and tie or a jacket and or, you know white and a, you know and a suit is just to be when you come to synagogue you want to be presentable. It's something for yourself, for your children. You want to show them something that's important, something that's you're not just going out to golf with friends. It's something that's important and serious to you. Hasidic Jews also traditionally will wear a certain Hasidic garb or whatever it is. It's probably not what you're seeing in Arizona, because even at the Chabad, which is a Hasidic synagogue, which is based on the it's a Hasidic group, it's not geared towards Hasidic Jews. It's geared towards all Jews, and therefore the people that you see there, they're not wearing necessarily the Hasidic garb. They're just wearing clothing that they want to be suitable for prayer when you pray to God. When you're coming to beseech or to, I know I do fundraising, so I know when you come to fundraising, you want to make sure that you. That you look presentable, so when you come to God and God, you know, this is the best person to fundraise from. Best idea of it.
Okay, but I've got to go back to, as you described, the Hasidic Orthodox member of that synagogue here doesn't necessarily find applicable the same rules of dress or worship as perhaps somebody in New York City or in Israel.
Explain that.
Well, you said in Phoenix, in Arizona, the rules even for the Hasidic members are different.
Oh no, that's not what I meant. What I meant is that the people you see going to Chabad on a regular Saturday or something like that, they might not be Hasidic themselves. Because the Chabad,
yes,
as the Chabad Center on Lincoln and all the Chabads in the state, they're outreach organizations and they're meant for all Jews and they're meant to bring Judaism and the joy of Judaism to everyone.
So how is that different than in the Bronx?
Well, if you had, let's talk about in Brooklyn, in Crown Heights, the Chabad community there, the synagogues there are geared towards the Chabad community. You're not going to hear anyone announcing pages. You know, that's because it's meant for people who are part of the Hasidic community, as opposed to here, it's meant for all Jews. What you would call Reform conservative, they would all feel comfortable coming to Chabad, and they're not putting on any black hats or fur hats or anything like that to come to services. But they might put on a nice shirt and you know, nice pair of pants. They might not also, but they might do that as a respect for the service for God.
If I went to a synagogue in Israel or in Poland or Russia, would I find that the worship service was dramatically different than at your father's synagogue on Lincoln Drive?
So it all depends. Certain groups of Judaism, for example, in Arizona, we have a big Bukharian community, which is from Uzbekistan, and they'll have a different service. Their melodies will sound different. Or if you went to a Moroccan or a Sephardic synagogue,
yes.
So also the melodies would be different. Also a little bit longer service. I've never been to one. That's why. No, but they would, and the melodies would be slightly different. The thing about Israel is that in Israel, in the same block, you can have all three synagogues, and there will be all totally different depending on where the people who come there are from.
So. Let's talk about Israel, because to so many people in America, that is their introduction to elements of Judaism. Sometimes that which is politically Jewish, and sometimes it's often confusing. So could we go back, and I didn't invite you here as a historian, but I'm depending on the fact that your father's kid probably is going to be able to come up with this, because he was really good when he was on this program.
Oh, and I thought you already spoke about it, so you already have it logged, you already have it put on the archive that you wouldn't ask about it.
The founding of Israel, when did it happen? And why?
Founding of Israel happened on the first day of creation.
What do you mean?
God created the world. On the first day of creation, he created the world. And in that, he created Israel. And he says that it was God's world, and he decided to give it to the Jewish people. So when Abraham was born, God gave him a couple tests. And after that, God promised him the land of Israel.
So is that part of Torah?
That is, it's actually... It's in the first verse of the Torah. Says, in the beginning God created the world, and the primary commentary on the Torah says that why did the Torah start from a historical perspective? The Torah is not a book of history, and he explains that the purpose of starting the Torah that way was God wanted to say it's my world, and I decide and I created the land of Israel, and I wanted to give it to the Jewish people.
Okay, but Israel is a geographic entity, and in no holy book that I know does it ever say that. And on the second day, God created Pennsylvania, or God created Beijing, or any other geographic...
You're reading the wrong books.
So is this the only geographic locale that is a part of teachings within the Jewish community?
Well, I mean, all lands are part of... has God created all lands? Is it one that God specifically gave to someone, as opposed to other nations, as opposed to any giving other lands to other people? So I would say from my understanding, that's the truth. That's the truth. And an interesting thing is that religion is usually about spirituality. It's usually about God.
Yes.
So religion doesn't really need a land, because it's not about the land. You could be Jewish, or you could be whatever religion you are, in any place in the world you want, because it's not specific to a land. But part of the job in Judaism is that we're supposed to infuse the physical mundane world with godliness, and in order to do that, you do need a land. You do need physical things. You can't just sit and meditate. You do need physical things to actually infuse the world or the world around you with Judaism, with godliness. And that's why, for the purpose that God chose the Jewish people for, Israel was a suitable place to be able to follow those God's mission of infusing the world with godliness.
Tell me what happened in 1947 when another founding of Israel took place.
It was just reinforcing what already happened. It wasn't, no one gave, no one, maybe on legalities, someone was giving the land of Israel to the Jewish people, but it was just, obviously, between me and you, they picked Israel only because of the first founding of Israel, was because God said so in the Torah. They didn't pick Israel for any other reason. They could have given Brazil or Atlanta or anything, like, you know, they could have done something else. They picked Israel because it was just reinforcing what God already gave the Jewish people.
And the concern that people had then, and has been the underpinnings of military conflicts ever since, has been that the land that was determined by the United Nations to be Israel, outside of what the Holy Scriptures say, that when the United Nations said, and now we're going to be determining that this is Israel, what was it before?
To me, it was always Israel.
No, all right, but to Baptists, what was it?
They might have called it Palestine. They might have called it whatever they wanted.
But was it Palestine, or was it another part of the Middle East? That's what I was asking.
For me, it was Israel. In other words, the land of Israel was always Israel. It was always called the Holy Land. It was always the Holy Land, and the paperwork was just to make things maybe legal amongst the nations. And the Jews, all throughout history, the people, some people always didn't, you know, there are always nations that didn't like the Jewish people throughout history, and that might continue for a while, might continue forever. Maybe that helps us do our mission. That helps us kind of, when you don't get content, when things are easy, then you get a little content. So maybe that, I don't know God's ways, but that's, I don't think that the giving of the land of Israel to the Jewish people in any way caused any more damage or politics or whatever that wouldn't have happened any other time.
But let's talk about the fact that you have been an oppressed people for as long as anybody can remember, and as long as anybody has read history. Why you? Why you more than other oppressed peoples, like Mormons, like Catholics, like the Rohingya people, who have been driven out of Myanmar, Burma, and now they're having to create these massive gatherings of human beings to the hundreds of thousands of people in Bangladesh. But why is it over the centuries, it seems as if someone has had it out for the Jews?
I wish I had the answer. If I had the answer, I'd probably have a big part of the solution. But there's, definitely the Jewish people have tried very hard to be on the forefronts of morals and ethics in the world, and to make change, and to bring godliness, and to bring, and to, you know, to make the world a more peaceful place. And it's possible that's something that bothers. But on the other hand, there's a general concept that when you try hard for something, how do you know that something is your life's mission? How do you know something is something that you're supposed to pursue? Is when it doesn't come easy. When it comes hard, you know you're doing the right thing. Because if the right thing came easy, then there wouldn't be free choice, and it would be a no-brainer to do the right thing. So automatically, when things come hard, you know that those are usually the right things. And just because there was oppression or different things throughout history, that sometimes reinforces that we know we're doing something right. Not that we definitely don't ask for any of these tsaras, we say in Yiddish, we don't ask for any of these problems, but it definitely doesn't take away from our belief that that's the right thing.
But you must have asked yourself, why you? Why Jews in general have carried this victimization?
But the difference is we don't carry any victimization. We were victims, but we don't carry that. In other words, you rarely go to a Jew and he's still crying over the fact that he left Egypt, that he was a slave in Egypt, or the fact that he was oppressed by the Spanish Inquisition. We do celebrate these holidays and remind ourselves, but the point of the holiday is not to complain and to cry about the fact that we were in Egypt.
But he still weeps over the Holocaust.
Weeping over the Holocaust is still very important. It's very raw and it's very important. But no one, for the most part, the better part of taking the better part of looking at the Holocaust is not weeping, but it's rebuilding. And weeping Weeping sometimes helps get emotions out of you, but it's important that it's you should also rebuild and to come out, and that's the best way to take the Holocaust to heart is to continue building and to continue the mission of the Jewish people at that time.
We're having a conversation with Rabbi Shlomi Levertov, who's one of the directors of the Chabad Jewish Center of Paradise Valley, active in the total community here, not just the Jewish community. And he's here to explain elements of Judaism that you probably would not have asked the Jew at the cocktail party when you happen to wind up at the same refreshment table. That's one of the reasons why the God Show is here. For example, the scriptures. How is the Torah different than the Old Testament?
The Torah is the Old Testament.
Is it different than the Old Testament, though, that is a part of the Christian Bible?
So I've never, it would be published by a different house. But I would say a primary difference is that the Old Testament is in English. Is that correct?
Well, if we want to understand it, yeah. And I suppose probably it's also in whatever language it's being published in.
Right. So anytime you have a translation, there's someone who translated it. So therefore, the best and most authentic way to study the Torah would be from the Hebrew. And obviously, that's not possible for everyone, and that's why there are translations. But it does have a lot of importance in studying it from the actual Hebrew, that you know that you're following a translation that is as accurate as possible. That's the only difference I would say. I've sat down with some people, and we've gone through different books and how it's written in their English translation, how it's written in the Hebrew, and you can see clearly that when people translate, they translate many times based on the way they understand or the way they want to understand or whatever it is. So the only when I refer to the Torah, obviously it's with English translation, but mainly it's still in its Hebrew text, and that's how you find the accuracy. There is one thing I wanted to mention. We spoke about just something I find interesting. We spoke about creation, is that we believe that when God created the world, he created a complete world. What came first, the chicken or the egg? And God created a complete world. There were trees, there were animals and everything. But when he created the human being, he only created one. And only after that did he create a second one to have Adam and Eve. He created Adam first. As opposed to when he created animals, he created, I don't know, 100 animals at a time, 200 animals at a time, or anything like that. And for me, that's an important lesson that the Mishnah, the Talmud, explains that that's an important message that every single person has to realize, that it was worth it for God to create the world just for one person. In other words, whatever religion you are, whatever it is that God chose to create the world, and when he created the humankind, he created one person and not a couple. And the lesson is that it's worth it to create the world just for one person. No one should ever feel that, I'm not an important player in the world or whatever. I'm not an important player in making change, or I'm not even important in the world and I have no importance and maybe I shouldn't be here. And the lesson what God wanted to teach us is that no, it was worth it. The whole world, the entire world, the water, the earth, everything was worth it for one person.
So within the structure of intellectual Judaism, are you anti-Darwin? When you say that God created all of the animals, was that at once over a long period of time? Did God consider evolution when he was creating the first Jew?
So I'll let everyone argue about that on their own. But
I'd like to hear your argument.
I study the Torah, and I follow it very literal, and it says God created the world.
On a given Tuesday. I'm just trying to clarify.
Yeah, I think it was started on Sunday, but yeah. But yeah, God created the world, and it says what he did every single day. And it makes the most sense to say that it was 24-hour days, just like we know now. But I'll leave that some Orthodox people might still have a different opinion in that, and that's okay. I'm open to hearing anybody's opinion, but that's from a literal perspective, that's what the Torah says.
Let's talk about the basic elements that non-Jews want to know about. And as I said a little while ago, they don't stop the person in the elevator and ask. So
some of these things we can't talk about on the radio.
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't you give it a try? And then we can cut out the parts that you find horribly offensive.
Oh, I didn't mean offensive.
That will only be after you go home, and you'll have to trust us. The symbols, what does the yarmulke stand for, the little cap?
So Jews are tend to be bald, so that was just a way of covering up bald.
Oh, stop that.
No, no. Okay. Well, to help our wives in the kitchen, sometimes you take out a hot pot. So it's always handy to have a. So.
See, I knew. We're talking about stand-up rabbinical humor.
Actually, I have a brother-in-law, and I suggested he gets a bigger one. He doesn't. He hasn't realized that it started. You know, the bald spot started expanding. Now, the real answer is that yarmulke is actually a Yiddish word. It's the way that people who speak Yiddish will call a yarmulke.
Well, let's talk about that right now before we go on. The difference between Hebrew and Yiddish.
The jokes in Yiddish are much better. That's I actually say every year at high holiday services, I explain why we still do the service in Hebrew, even though most people don't understand Hebrew who are attending my service. And I say, because, you know, Jackie Mason always says, he says, you take a good Yiddish joke and you translate it into English, and he says, it just doesn't go. So for me, I say, you know, you take a good Jewish prayer and you translate it into English, and you miss a lot of the juice of the prayer. So we continue praying in Hebrew, but we explain everything in English, etc.
Hold on just a moment. There is a family that is calling in right now from Latvia. Thank you very much, our Latvian line. And they said, ask him again about the difference between Yiddish and Hebrew. We really want to know.
Oh, wow. So Yiddish was just a... In my life, Yiddish was just a language that my grandparents spoke, so we shouldn't understand. And whenever the conversation got heated, it just turned to Yiddish, and I was like, "Wait, what's going on? I thought we were talking." But it's just a language that Jewish people have spoken throughout the ages, and it's a nice language, maybe similar to German, but you might not understand. If you know Yiddish, you probably won't understand.
But Hebrew
German.
Is a formal tongue.
Yeah, Hebrew is a formal tongue. The Torah is written in Hebrew, and that's more formal. But many times, Jewish people throughout history spoke Yiddish. And the concept of a yarmulke comes from the words yore malka, which means you fear heaven. And it was a concept of you always put something on top of your head to remind you that God is always above you, God's always watching.
But you always wear your yarmulke.
I always wear my yarmulke. I take it off in the shower and when I'm swimming.
No, but that's...
other than that, I sleep with my yarmulke.
Why?
Always have to remember there's never a time to think that God's not above you and God's not watching you.
All right, the talis is a scarf that I see used in worship in the synagogue. What's the significance of that?
So the talis is actually, it's bigger than a scarf. The scarf is the Prius version of the talis. I like using the Cadillac version. So the talis is actually, could be a little bit bigger than that. It goes on your back. And the purpose of the talis was to remind you of all the commandments that God gave us. So there's everything in Hebrew has a numerical value. The numerical value of the word of tzitzis, which is what the Hebrew for talis, is 600, and it comes out to be 600 with, there's five knots and eight strings, which is 613. So it reminds us of the 613 commandments that God gave us.
Is that, those are the knots in the talis, or is it also that knotted area around the belt line?
There's a string that comes out of the talis that has five knots, and eight strings.
I'm looking now.
And so these five knots and eight strings, that's 13. And the numerical value of the word tzitzis is 600. That's 613. What I find interesting about the knots is that if you were going to pull up Google and you were going to search for a good icon for a reminder, what icon would come up?
The rosary. I would think in terms of beads.
Okay. I Googled it, and that could come up too, but there's sometimes a finger with a little bow on it, which is a knot. Because knots were always a way of reminding people. When you had something to do, you just put a knot somewhere. You're like, hey, what's the knot doing there? And it was a reminder. And it has some mystical understanding of that too. And that's part of why the talis has five knots.
Are there legal areas of recreation that are not acceptable within the world of Hasidic Judaism? Dancing.
No, dancing is definitely acceptable. Obviously, male with male and female with female.
Well, you say obviously. I mean, if we go out, my wife and I go out dancing, it would not be obvious to me that I would go to the table next door and ask the gentleman named Arthur if he would go out on the dance floor.
That is true. So that would be true. So for in the In the Orthodox Judaism, it would be male with male and female with female.
Why?
Well, if you can't shake someone's hand, you definitely can't dance with them.
Well, I don't think audience necessarily knows about the handshaking either.
So as a way of modesty, male don't shake hands with females unless it's your spouse, and same thing would be with dancing or any other physical touch.
I have asked a couple of other guests in the past, and I really am anxious to find out what your answer is. Why does there seem to be a disproportionate few professional athletes who are Jewish, with the abundant number of Catholics and Presbyterians and Muslims and a huge variety of people? You find Al Rosen, Sandy Koufax, and literally a handful of people who were observant Jews who went on to play professional sports. Do you have a theory?
I don't have a theory. I just know it's hard to eat cholent, which is a stew that we have on Shabbos, and then go out to the basketball court and do some exercise. I don't have a theory, but there are some Jewish players more that you've seen throughout history, and it's also, if you wanted to keep Shabbat, and sometimes it gets a little harder when you're in professional athlete or stuff like that, or not playing on Yom Kippur, which
to be present for the holy holidays and also Sabbath,
etc. Yes,
I have been told that it's also as a result of non-Jewish kids going out and playing ball all the time while the Jewish kids were studying.
I would love to say that's true, but I don't know. What I know is that air is free, so it's not that's not the reason that's stopping us from playing sports.
Is there a limit on different kinds of recreation and entertainment that the rest of us consider to be just regular, daily, acceptable activities? Going to the movies.
So it's hard. It's a broad question, and for me, Judaism is so much a part of my life, and I don't find any limitations. So if you're asking me if there's a limit, for me, there's no limit. But if you ask me about a specific case, I'd be like, hey, maybe you're right, I can't do that. But so, for me, I don't feel limited in any way.
So you're not talking about something that is applicable to all Jews then?
Well, I'm saying myself, I don't find any limits in anything I want to do recreational. I mean, nowadays everyone wants to be on the computer all day, so that's allowed. No, but I don't find any limits. So for me, it's, you know, when it comes to movie theaters, there are plenty of Jewish people who go to movie theaters. I personally don't. But
why?
I'd like to use up my time for things that get my brain moving, and you know, a little bit. If I have an extra 20 minutes, then maybe I'll study something or try to do something.
You watch television?
I don't watch television.
But that's
a personal thing.
So that has nothing to do with the rules of the Torah, the rules of behavior.
For the most part. I mean, if there are scenes on TV or in movies that aren't clean and aren't modest, then I would say that even if you're not a Jew, it's not something to, it's not a society that you want to bring into your house or into your life. It doesn't help marriages and doesn't help relationships and many other things that it actually ruins.
What do you think is the reason for, and I'm asking you a political question now, because also many folks don't understand whether there is something regarding Israel that is religious, is it political, is it both, or is it neither? Was it an appropriate thing for the president to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem? And what is it that's unique about Jerusalem that was not unique about Tel Aviv?
Well, I'm not going to talk about the politics of it, but I'll talk about the Jewish part of it, is that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, and Israel decided it's the capital of Israel, and they have a government like any other country, and they can decide where the capital is, and if that's the capital, that's probably where the embassy should be. But on a general level, Jerusalem is a holy city, and there's something very special about it. Throughout history, that was always the place that Jewish people went to pray to God. Says that even now, all our prayers go by way of Jerusalem, and that's the way it goes from there to heaven to God. So Jerusalem was always an important part of Israel. It's from the four holy cities, and it's something that I don't want to make Israel a political. You know, to me, Israel's not a political thing. It's a holy country.
But it seems strange that it has taken since 1947 for the capital of Israel, Jerusalem, to be recognized by the rest of the world as the home of the U.S. Embassy, because everybody else decided for themselves where the embassies ought to be, and almost always it was the capital.
So that's where it comes to be politics. And Jews and politics, I don't know, we don't want to get there.
Do you think there'll ever be a Jewish president in your lifetime?
I don't know. To me, it's not a... It might be a nice idea. Maybe if it happened, I would find it nice. But to me, I don't need there to be a Jewish president. I'm fine if there are other presidents, as long as they're good to the people of the United States and have a good relationship with Israel. And are, you know, to me, it doesn't. You don't have to be Jewish to make good decisions. And so that doesn't have to be. To me, it's not such a big deal if there be a Jewish president.
Would it not seem to you that it would be something akin to the bias against Catholics? That in all of the years that we've had presidents since 1776, there's only been one Catholic president, but there's been no Jews.
Jews don't like making enemies, I guess. They figured it's better to stay away. You know, there's a rabbi who got up in his synagogue on the holiest day of the year, on Yom Kippur, and he was talking about repentance, and so he said, you know, does anybody have any enemies? He's trying to get everyone to forgive their enemies, and he said, you know, if you have any enemies, stand up, and this. And everybody stood up, and then he went down, and everybody started sitting slowly, and one lady was still standing, so he said, I don't understand. You don't have any enemies to forgive? She says, no. I outlived them all. So some Jews are smarter than that. They don't want to get involved in the politics.
I think if this rabbinical thing doesn't work out for you, the Jackie Mason School of Comedy might possibly be a choice that you might want to consider. By the way, when I was in Israel a long, long time ago, our guide told me that there was a greater bond between Jews and members of Islam, Jews and Muslims, than between Jews and Christians, because, and he said at least, that he was speaking for Judaism and not just for this guide's opinion. He said it's because Islam and Judaism are monotheistic, that they believe only in one God, and that Christians and Catholics in particular, with the statues and the symbolism and saints and so on, seem to spread their worship across a broad range. Your thoughts?
Then if there's that bond, your tour guide should go remind them of it. But I mean, there is that connection that we believe in one God, and so I guess if you want to find a connection, you can find. There are probably many other things that you could find that are very different about our religions. So I don't, you know, I guess your tour guide found one connection and made a story out of it.
Are you an optimist by nature?
I'm an optimist.
Then do you believe that in your lifetime? I won't even suggest in my lifetime, because I think I only have a few days left. But in your lifetime, that there will be a recognition of Israel by the Muslim governments of the Middle East, and that there will be peace in your time.
So I strongly believe one of the 13 principles of the Jewish faith is that believe in the coming of the Messianic era, of Mashiach. And I strongly believe.
But explain that.
There'll be a leader of the Jewish people that's appointed by God. Jewish people will rebuild the temple, and will continue serving and worshiping in the temple. And it'll be a time of world peace. It's actually written on the building of the UN that, you know, everything will all military equipment will turn into, you know, farming equipment, and everything will be used for peace. And it'll be a time that there will be no wars. And I believe strongly that can happen. Tomorrow, it can happen today, it can happen now, it can happen in your lifetime. And the Chabad Rebbe, that was a big part of his whole push of opening up Chabad centers around the world and sending rabbis and trying to bring Judaism to all Jews was to usher in this time of the Messianic era and the time of world peace. And I believe it can happen now.
But it doesn't seem to be even closer than it was last year or...
It's like a surprise party.
10 or 15 years ago. Yes. But we said that when President Carter had a Palestinian leader and an Israeli leader, in front of the White House, clasping hands. And that was going to be the day that was the beginning of peace in our time. What happened?
Well, we've said it in the Holocaust too. We said it throughout our history. Jews have been saying it always, but we believe that as things sometimes become darker, you start realizing that maybe it's more opportune, as maybe it's coming to a deep time, as opposed, sometimes Judaism was at a high, there was revelation, and then things we had a temple, then things went, you know, things changed. So sometimes the darker it gets is because it's the darkness right before the bright light of daylight, and that's kind of the, sometimes as things get darker, it just means that the light is right around the corner.
Must those settlements be built in what is debated and argued land as to the ownership of that property, the Gaza Strip?
Oh wow! In the last couple of minutes, you're getting very heated now.
Oh no! If your answer is good, we'll extend this for 2 or 3 hours.
Again, not from a political point of view, but
I don't know how you avoid a political point of view.
You'll find out right now.
Okay.
If the land of Israel is governed by Israel, then they have the right to build. And no one came to Arizona and said, there's different areas in, you know, oh, this is where the Indians were, and don't come there. If it's governed by Israel and Israel, then they have the ability to set up homes. You know, Israel is pretty crowded, and there's need for new homes, and that's.
But is there no Palestinian land now?
I think that I was in Israel recently, and there are plenty of Palestinians or Arabs or whatever who are living in Israel, and they're just fine. What you hear on the news is not what you see when you go visit. And there are plenty of people who aren't Jewish, and there are Arabs, and they're living in Jerusalem. They're living in Jerusalem. They're living in other parts of Israel, and they're happy. And it's what the media portrays is, you know, kind of two sides. You walk into Jerusalem, and you right away see that it's not true. You're walking next to people who aren't Jewish, and they're Arabs, and they look like they're enjoying Israel. So they're not necessarily the ones who are fighting the land and stuff like that.
Help me become more Jewish. This is a question I've never had answered, and I really would like to ask you as we close this hour out, because then I will be purified if I have the absolute honest answer. I've always considered that faithful Jewish people are among the most tolerant people that I know. And I'm talking about the ones that I know. I can't speak for anybody else. But they seem to be folks who embrace so many others of different beliefs, different attitudes, different ways of dressing. And yet I read every so often about extreme Orthodox representatives of the faith in Israel virtually attacking students as they would pass by their area if they didn't agree with the way they dress. You know the stories that I'm talking about.
So so there's two things. First of all, I haven't read about it in a long time. That's number one. But the other thing is that in every group of people, there are people who run their own show, and those are the ones who are going to make it to the news. That doesn't mean that everyone's like that. And a good lawyer in New York once told me that the difference between, that basically in society, some people become criminals, and some people with those same tendencies will find a good job that has similar ideas of using guns and using force and stuff like that. And they just guided that into you know, something that's legal or whatever it is. So there are people who have certain tendencies, and it exists everywhere. And when you're going to have a community that has thousands of people, you're going to always have some people who want to either pick a fight or do something. And that shouldn't talk for the whole people. That should just talk for those people who decided to do the actions that they did and that you read about in the newspaper. But that doesn't mean that everyone is like that, and doesn't mean that it's acceptable, and doesn't mean that it should be done. And I definitely don't think it should be done. And I think it's not acceptable, but I don't think that that talks for the whole group of people.
But isn't it flattering, though? Isn't it complimentary to Judaism in general that those isolated incidents should make the news because they were surprises? We didn't expect it from Jews.
I guess if everyone reading the news had the uh, had the ability to realize that, then yes. But otherwise, people look at that and, you know, not everyone's so smart when they see articles like that in the news and say, oh, it's only made it to the news because it only happened once, as opposed to things that happen every single day in, you know, downtown or whatever state you want or whatever it is.
What should we know right now in this year, 2018, about Judaism as it exists now?
What should we know it could be any minute? This like Maimonides says that you should look at your life and at the world as if it's a scale, that any single one good deed can tip the scale and usher in the Messianic era and bring a time of world peace. And no one should think that they're not the MVP player of it, but they should realize that they are. You know, it's really upon them to make sure to make those decisions and to make those good choices and those good deeds to bring in time of world peace.
I couldn't think of a better way to close that out. I thank you so much. Shalom. It's always fascinating to me to find out about the feelings and the beliefs and the genuine ways of life of people that you and I might not necessarily know as much about, but know now because of The God Show.